before you got time to think about what?
Well, what I'm doing here, dude. What if I'm in trouble right now.
You might need to sit a little closer.
Is it picking me up now?
No, I just, you know. Oh, okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah. So like 3 to 5 inches, you know what I'm saying?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's...
So yeah. like half of what you're packing. Think about
or
that.
Or project like you're up on stage. You ever been up on stage?
I can project.
Okay.
Like that?
Yeah, just like that.
Like you're in the courtroom, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, no, Your Honor. It wasn't me.
Do you plead guilty?
It was him over there.
Okay, okay. This is getting too familiar. What's up, Dustin? How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. Don't mess with the mic. It's going to pick up all those little touches.
All the movements.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
It's staring at me.
It doesn't have eyes.
You should put googly eyes on it.
That's not a bad idea.
It's not.
Yeah. Maybe it'll like...
It'll
help people relax.
With my anxiety.
Yeah.
Oh, look at the cute little...
Why do you have anxiety?
Eyes. Oh, I don't.
Oh.
I don't. I'm coming into it like I'm shooting the shit with a couple of my boys, you know?
That's all it is.
Cool. That's all it is.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
That then maybe might go out into the world.
Yeah. I want to talk about butt sex, prison.
That's all I got, isn't it? That's all I came with. So, I mean, I hope that's all we're talking about.
So for those who are listening who don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh God. All right. My name's Dustin. I was, born and raised in, Mesa, Arizona, which is Phoenix for anyone who doesn't live in Phoenix or Mesa or the surrounding areas. Everyone's very adamant about where they came from down in the valley. You know,
right.
I'm from Mesa. I'm from East Mesa,
right.
You know?
It's all just one big clusterfuck.
Yeah, though, to really, anyone that doesn't live there, it's just a clusterfuck. Grew up, you know, middle class. I'm adopted. So right out the gate, let's get that out the way. I was adopted at like organized or not organized beforehand. You
right.
Know? It was set up, paperwork and all that stuff.
Was it like a closed adoption?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was open. I think there's a chance that I could look into it.
Right.
And find out who my birth parents are. My mom said I could contact the attorney if I ever wanted to or whatever. But you know, in my mind, I see, other than like health and stuff, I don't really see a reason to, I try to stay open-minded.
Right.
I did the 23andMe, you know, because I figured the government's already got my DNA in it because I went to prison. So I didn't worry about all that. Yeah, I try to stay open-minded to it, but my parents almost my dad's paralyzed from the waist down. He got in a motorcycle accident when he was 18. Therefore the adoption.
Right.
Those are the reasons.
No.
Not able to have kids. So, you know, I knew when I said the words adopted and stuff, like I would get a reaction out of people and it was usually, oh, you are. So I kind of felt special. So I had no idea what it meant. I was like, I'm adopted, motherfuckers, you know? So, I mean, I grew up in the Mormon religion. I know that's been on this show. That's been on this show before. And you know, I mean, they're good. They're good people, and I really, you know, I don't really have anything bad to say about the Mormon people themselves. You know, I always felt I didn't know any different. You know, I'd go to church on Sunday, and this is what we learned about God, and you know, don't ask me too many questions about the religion because I kind of screwed my brain up, and I don't really remember a lot. But I did show up every Sunday. I know that. But it just wasn't the right fit for me, is the best way to describe it, I guess. I just didn't fit into my,
I have a hard time with any, like, organized religion being, like, a good fit for me, so.
Yeah. Jonah. You know? I think that's because we're special. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, I can say that I felt that way before, right? You know what I mean? Like, there's times where I thought that organized religion was the fit for me a couple times, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not the case currently, but I do feel like it's full of good people trying to get work, you know what I mean?
I mean, I feel like we found it elsewhere.
Right.
You know, but it... What doesn't work for some may work for others, type of deal. And if I didn't have this, this disease or whatever, I might, who knows? You know, I could have gone on a mission. I could have still been spreading the, taking cookies over to my neighbors and say, hey, you want to get baptized or what? There was always something. I know people say that, you know, there's something that I just didn't fit in. And when I started like not following the very, black and white guidelines of the religion, let's burn the rest of it to the ground, you know, and that was my disease manifesting itself before I even really knew what was happening. So, you know, I was good at sports. You know, my dad coached high school football. He worked full time. You know, I mentioned he was in a motorcycle accident. He had a scholarship to play football at BYU, and he wasn't Mormon. It just happened to be the school that he was got a scholarship to. He graduated from Coconino up here, and all state linebacker and all that stuff. And I guess he was a beast, and an old lady that couldn't see anything, had no business driving, pulled out in front of him when he was headed down by the bowling alley off of 66 here. And witnesses said he went 10 to 15 feet up in the air over two lanes of traffic and landed next to the railroad, the dirt in the railroad, which, you know, I guess the layout's a little different nowadays, but, and his Bell helmet split in half, and he, tried to get up, and that's when he knew something was wrong. And, but he didn't let that stop him. I guess there was a point in the hospital because, you know, he had his whole life ahead of him. And imagine, I can't imagine.
Right.
I can't even begin to fathom my ability to walk in life,
right,
being taken from me, you know.
Especially at such a young age with, like, a football scholarship and, like, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of shit they make movies about, you know.
Yeah, dude, remember the Titans, dude? Yeah. I shed a couple tears, you know what I mean? I'm man enough to admit that, you know. There's a point where his dad was, and this is, you know, my interpretation of it. I don't know if he were here, if the story would be the same, but there was a point where, you know, he's obviously feeling pretty down and out about the situation at hand, and he was just kind of, you know, pretty miserable. And my grandpa came in and he opened up the curtains and he said, you know, look at all them people out there and the cars and people walking down the street and stuff. And, whether you decide to sit in here and feel sorry for yourself or to get up and try to make the best of it, life's going to keep going. This was the hand that you're dealt, and what you do with it, it's on you. You know, nobody's going to make you get up and do what you know, and try to make the best of this situation.
Right.
And I guess that was enough, you know. He got a little settlement, which is, you know, when you look back on it, is like, that ain't shit. You know what I mean? For what has happened. You know, he's able to kind of start a life from there. He met my mom when he was doing rehabilitation down there in Phoenix in one of the rehab centers, got her number, called her a year or two later, and that's how they met, you know. And that's kind of one of the reasons I believe that everything kind of happens for a reason, in life, and nothing is not meant, you know, no matter how cruel or, you know, terrible. I really feel like that things happen for a reason in life, and that's kind of how I came about, you know. And I don't mean to backtrack, but they had tried adopting. They paid for all the ladies' medical bills, maternity, all that stuff, clothes and everything. And she had the baby and she decided to keep it. And I guess in the state of Arizona, you know, you don't get that money. You don't get that money back. No. You know? And it's the mother's choice up until whatever. You know, no matter what paperwork is filled out and what you've put into it. And so my mom was pretty, she was pretty upset about it, as I'm sure, you know, anyone would be in that sort of situation. And so my dad, you know, had to do a little, you know, a little convincing. And, you know, and that's how I was brought into the family that I was in. So.
So I'm curious, what did the 23andMe
tell reveal?
You? Yeah.
I don't have my phone right here. It opened up some doors. And that was a weird time in life when we were going through school and they're asking what your heritage is and people are going around, "Oh, I'm Italian, blooded," and it gets to me, and you know, I may have been smoking a little pot around the time, you know, and I'm like, I don't know, and the teacher's like, "What do you mean you don't know?" And I'm like, I'm adopted. I literally have no clue.
Right.
And I was the only kid in class that didn't know, you know. I mean, I'm pretty much a mutt. I think 23andMe does that for most people. Like it separates it out. It's like I have. 0.7% Ethiopian. So you know what I mean? Like just some crazy stuff.
I can see it now, actually.
Yeah, I'm just climbing that's in my pants. But it opened up the doors because there's connections with people that have other people that you're blood related to.
Right.
And I started, you know, Facebook stalking some cousins and stuff. And I, you know, worked my way. I had a 14-something% match with someone, a cousin of mine. And, you know, and I shot a text. I shot a messenger, you know, and, we talked and, you know, I've had, you know, I've connected with about three or four people from it, and they, you know, they say, "We think we know, we're almost 100% sure, both on mom's side and dad's side, but I've never," they ask what I want to know, and then I say, you know, I try to stay open-minded, and that was it.
That's
it. I haven't gotten a message back, so,
right.
I mean, it's all unfolded within the past year or two, and some of it pretty recently, past month or so, I started talking to a new cousin in Utah. And so, yeah, I mean, it kind of, it is what it is, you know, and I'd like to know because when it was just me in life, hey, whatever, you know, the health stuff I'll take as it comes. But when I've passed on to my daughter,
right.
You know, I'd like to know kind of what runs in the family and stuff like that. I don't know, man. I don't know.
That's pretty intense, man. So I want to kind of like segue into butt stuff in prison a little bit.
Hell yeah, dude.
Well, let's first, what...
Do I pull my pants down now, or...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know why they're not off already.
Yeah,
I tried to. You guys said, "Hey,
I did not stop you at all."
It's true, Rich.
I'll take pictures, dude. I don't care. Let's start with like your first experience with drugs and how that led.
Do you remember the first time?
What was your first time like?
Oh my god. So my first time. You know, there was always something going on over in the secret squirrel society of the popular kids. You know what I mean? And I was always on the edge of that popularity. I was short. I had glasses. You know, I kind of fit in. I kind of didn't. But, you know, the party thing back in junior high, drinking and stuff like that. Obviously, I was raised with certain beliefs that, you know, you don't do that, and it kind of makes you a bad person. But I wanted to fit in so fucking bad, you know. And I went to a party, and you know, and I drank, and I had no, like, there was no crazy aha moment for me, and I might have just forgotten it if there was, you know, as they say. But once I had, you know, if I had some alcohol or a way to get it, or if I had some weed, I fit in suddenly with everyone, you know? And I kind of ran with that, you know? And then obviously I felt like the shame and the guilt of, right, of the way I was raised.
Yeah. But that outweighed, like, you felt like you finally belonged.
Right.
You know?
And I totally just dove head first into all that shit. Because I wasn't good enough to make it in sports. I was really good, but I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't big enough, you know? And my dad coached in high school football. I was always around football. And I love football. I'd go to the games. I was water boy, you know? I was always there from a young age on the field with the players. I loved it. I loved the atmosphere, but I just wasn't big enough. I was like third string quarterback when I finally got to full contact, you know. I did great at flag football, but I got to full contact and I was the littlest fella on the field, you know, and I was really good at quarterback, but I couldn't see over the goddamn line. So, I mean, you know, there's only so much you can do, right? You know? And I had a coach when I tried out for the basketball team in junior high. He said, you know, you're really good. You're one of the best point guards we've got out here, but there's a guy that's just as good as you and he's a little bit taller than you. And I said, well, fuck, you know? And so I filled that shit. I filled it with, you know, the party scene and all that shit. Cause nobody denies you if you got a little bit of weed or you got some, a plug on some alcohol or whatever, you know? And
I think your coach would have.
Wait, fuck that guy. Yeah. Fuck that coach. If you're listening, fuck you.
You don't want me on the team, coach?
Yeah.
Fuck you, then. I ain't sharing my weed.
Yeah, you ain't getting none of this dirt weed, bud.
So, you know, alcohol and weed's all fun and dandy, but let's talk about
the good stuff. Oh, you want to talk about the good shit.
I want to talk about the good stuff.
Talk about boofing some fucking, yeah, some speed. Huh?
Have you ever done that?
No.
Oh. No. I was going to ask. I knew a couple of guys like
that would take some shards up the ass, and that was a sight to see.
You watched them do it?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Sorry, babe. <You know? laughs> Yeah, it's crazy down in the valley, man. I mean, they call it Valley of the Sun, Valley of the Spun, you know, and things evolve rather quickly.
I've actually never heard that before, yeah, but it makes sense.
Now you have, dude. Sunny Dope, Sunny Slope, Dysfunction Junction, Apache Junction, you know. It progressed real quick for me. The weed, selling weed to, you know, pills, coke, and I think I was trying to look speed for the first time when I was 16. And I was always hanging out with the older kids. I had a friend of mine that was older, out of school, living on his own. And, you know, him and his buddy were growing weed and selling it and making hash and doing all that shit. And so, you know, I was selling a little for him and doing some of that. And then, you know, and they were dabbling in heroin and stuff like that. I think I hit my first rehab when I was 18. And I was homeless before I was 18. Because my parents said, you know, hey, if you ain't going to school, you're getting a job. And you're out if you don't do any of those things. And I said, well, I got enough couches I can go surf, you know. I got friends. And that didn't last very long, you know. I would use up and burn all my relationships and move on to the next one before there wasn't anything left, anywhere to go. So who did I call? You know, I called my parents. Oh, I need help, you know, and because I didn't have anything. Called my dad at work and he said, all right, we'll get you some help. For whatever reason, they chose a rehab up in Park City, Utah. My dad took out of his 401k. I would relate it to B2B, you know, back to basics type of thing. You know, it was good money. And I went out there and I just wasn't ready, you know. I got a little bit of weight back on me. I got a house a place to live and I did it. And I came back between the inpatient and the outpatient. I graduated inpatient, came back or went I said I wanted to go see my family, and I was already hitting up, dude, before I even got off the plane. I kept pushing my flight back, and, you know, I came back all shot out, and I was like, it's really hard out there, you know, it's hard saying no and seeing old people, and they saw right through my bullshit, and I had to go to detox. I had a couple of ecstasy pills and stashed in my shoe, and it was just, you know, life just got, it was out of control. When I came back from Park City, you know, my parents had some pretty strict rules of what it looked like if I were going to live with them. Abided by those rules for about 24 hours, I would say. Met a girl that had a place, her own little apartment, and a speed addiction, meth addiction, and a job, dude. I was like, how are you doing this? You're older, show me your ways, you know? And I had the connect. And so I think I was living with her within a week or two. She would go to work and my job would be to track down the dope. I'd drop her off and take her car. And, you know, I was just going, robbing, stealing, doing whatever we needed to with the dope man, to re-up. You know, it was an everyday thing. And they were older as well, and they had a home in 40s, 50s, and, you know, everything from looking outside
looked great.
Fantastic. He had a brand new truck. He had a house with a backyard, the dogs, the girlfriend, and a speed addiction. You know, it's like, oh,
why can't I do this?
This is normal, yeah. Right?
Like, it is manageable.
Yeah, it is manageable. And so I kind of veered away from the pill scene and the heroin that I had dabbled in before going to rehab, and just strictly went to speed and alcohol. And, you know, I lived with her for a while, and we were trying to quit. I wasn't. But she thought I was. She was drinking in place of the meth. And we had drinking all the alcohol one Friday night. And she sent me with her roommate to go get more at Walmart. I was headed to one of the Walmarts. And coming down from the off-ramp, and the light turned yellow. And I was like, fuck it, I'm running it. And the person in front of me was like, I gotta stop right here, right now. And obviously I had a little bit of, you know, stuff in my system, and, I hit him, and we pulled into the parking lot, and, you know, I'd kind of talked my way out of it. It was his mom's car. It was my lady's car. I wasn't on the insurance. And I say, hey, man, can we just exchange information? And, you know, his wasn't too bad. Hers was pretty bunched up, and, you know, and he's like, yeah, that works. And then, truck pulls up and says, I'm an off-duty paramedic. Police and fire department are on their way. I've already called. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna call my mom real quick. And you know, I pretended like I was on the phone and walked until I got out of sight, and then I ran. and I literally called my mom, and she said, what happened? And I said, just come get me. She came and got me. You know, I disposed of what I had on me. We went to the house, and she said, you're not staying here. And I said, okay. And I grabbed a beer or two out of the fridge that my dad had stashed away, and took off. Went to the park, you know, kind of feeling sorry for myself, thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? Talked to one of the security guards that came by, and, you know, I'm, you know, like, practically in tears. And he's like, you know, the best way to handle it is to fess up and all this shit. And so I'm like, all right, I gotta handle this. You know, I'm gonna take it head on. And I come around the corner from the park, going back to my mom's, and there's a bunch of Mesa PD cops. I'm like, oh, I'll go the other way. So I ran. You know, I ran. That was kind of a thing for me. I ran from everything when it got bad. And I've always been a runner. Ended up getting caught up for that. She didn't know how to tell her mom that she had some 20-year-old meth head with no job, you know, nothing going on in his life, why he crashed her car. So she kicked me out, or broke up with me, or whatever, both, you know. And so, you know, I started living at the speed dealer's house, and it just got worse, you know, because then I was on the front lines every day. I was their runner. I was driving his truck, dropping shit off, doing what I had to do to get high every day. It got crazy.
So how did that lead up the prison time? Yeah, I know you didn't do a lot of prison time.
No, I didn't do a terrible amount. You know, around 18 months, 2 years, somewhere in there, in prison. And I did a lot of county time. A lot of slaps on the wrists. A lot of, hey, you got a warrant. Let's go in overnight type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then I moved up here. You know, I thought it was the area I was living in that was the problem. It wasn't me. By this time, I had gone to rehab. I was about 23-ish years old. Gone to rehab. You know, it was always a similar story at the end, man. I had nowhere to go, no place to fucking, I had nothing. So I'd go to rehab. Yeah, this is my only option, you know. And I hit rehab and my dad, you know, came to visit me and he's like, so got an opportunity and you can move up to Flag. You ain't gonna live with us. You ain't gonna live with me or your mom or any of that. You can move up to Flag and live with your Uncle Mike. You'll work pretty much room and board and you may make a little bit of money, but it'll get you out of here. And I said, all right, run it, you know. So I moved up here. You know, down there, I was a small fish in a big pond. You know, they ain't worried about the shoplifting dude unless you're caught red-handed type of deal. And moved up here, and I had no connections. I was living way out off of Loop Road and working every day. And one day, I finally convinced my uncle that it might not be a terrible idea just to let me drink. You know, I can drink. I can drink. I just...
I work hard. I work hard. I can have a beer.
I deserve a fucking beer after work.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, and I'm an alcoholic, you know? It's just through and through. I can't stop. I'm hiding shit. I'm drinking out of every person's house that I'm in, you know? If they have alcohol in the cabinet, I'll find it and drink it and put water in it, you know? And just like I'm, like, 16 at home, you know? So one night I got the idea that I was going to go meet this girl that cut my hair. I was going to meet her downtown because she said her and her friends were going down there. I'm like, yeah, I could use a night out, you know. I have no ride, you know. And I knew how bad the idea sounded, but the more I drank, the better the idea got that I can, you know, take his neighbor's work truck and go meet them downtown, you know? And by the time I ended up arriving there, I was super drunk. It started snowing. I tried to park the F-550 truck downtown, and I got stuck to where if I went forward and hooked it left, I would hit a telephone pole. If I backed up, I would hit a wall. And if I tried to go around the telephone pole, I would hit a wall. And the wheels were just spinning. And I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I'd never driven in snow. And so I left it. I went inside to try to, you know, meet the girl. And I didn't see them. And, you know, I got more drunk. And came back outside and proceeded to... throw up hanging out of the truck thinking like, how am I going to get out of this situation? And then that's when Flag PD came in and, you know, they tried to get me to do a field sobriety test. I said, no, fuck you, you know? So they, you know, they got a warrant for my blood. They took me in and, my blood alcohol level was like 0.28, 0.26, over three times the legal limit.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, all right, DUI, you know what I mean? Damn, that's a little bigger than the shit I'm used to, you know, but, you know, the more I talk to people in there, they're like, hey, you know, it's just DUI, you'll be out soon, you know? And so then I'm trying to figure out how am I going to get, what am I going to do when I get out of here? You know, how am I going to make this right? Well, the gentleman that owned the truck handled that for me and pressed charges because I wasn't allowed to take the truck. He had given me permission other times, but not that night, and especially not drinking and driving.
Right.
So Big Gomez from county came in with his recorder on and proceeded to read me. After they didn't release me, they put me in trustee pod or one of the pods for some reason, and they pull me out and he's got his camera on and he proceeds to read me, you know, theft of means, burglary in the third degree, you know, the big boy charges. And I'm like, oh, fuck, no, you know, I was scared. This ain't no slap on the wrist. So I did, felt sorry for myself for about a month, and that's the longest I had ever done at that point. This was in 2012. About a month in, I heard about Exodus, put in a kite, and that was my first experience. Other than the rehabs, that was the first experience where I felt like I had no more moves, you know, and I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do. And
what do you mean put in a kite? I'm not everybody's familiar.
Oh, I'm sorry. A kite. I'm sorry, Richie. A kite is just like you fill out your request, your need, whether it's medical or any of that. And they'll,
so it's just like a request
form. It's a request form, pretty much. Okay. They call them kites. Because, people,
you fly a kite.
In county, it's not such a big deal. In prison, you got to have that, normally you get it checked before somebody else sees what you're writing because they don't want no snitches up in there. So flying a kite can be
I gotcha.
Weird territory. And they'll get back to you in about 2 to 3 weeks. Especially when your teeth hurt. Fucking trying to get a dental. Yeah, they're in no rush for you. So I hit Exodus. Oh, Mike V wasn't in there. You can edit that, right? We're good.
Yeah.
Wasn't in there as Margot and some other person.
I remember Margot.
Yeah. A little older lady, and I was like, I don't know
what I'm you not a magician, okay? So let's not use everybody's names.
It's just a first name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all good.
Got out, did the foundation house, got a little taste of what life might be like without drugs and alcohol. I started gaining shit back. You know, it's always been a good idea that I might be able to drink, or I deserve a little bit of fun, or I'm going to do everything that they're asking except for this. It was a revolving door for me. I started off on standard probation, and I just kept going in and out. And kept getting taken back in on probation violations or whatever it may be, dirty UAs, till it got to the point where know that I have a dirty UA coming up, and I would just run, I wouldn't even give them the chance to lock me up because I didn't want to get locked up. I was faking my UAs for a while. A friend of mine had taught me how he was doing it. Show me your ways,
Drink a couple ounces of bleach.
heating up the fake piss or someone else's piss in the Circle K microwave next door and getting it to temperature. And you had this little setup that I had going, dude. And I was kind of getting away with it. So then I was just kept doing it until I would mess up so bad that I wouldn't show up for my UA. I'd miss it because I was so worried about how I'm going to get through it and get it right. Swear I don't get caught, and I would overthink it. And I
did you have to buy some people's piss? Or they just pee for you.
I would throw people money that were clean, but most of the time I was pretty good at just convincing someone. Hey man, just let me get a little bit of your piss, dude. You're clean, right? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I bought UAs before.
So. Yeah, and I kept going in and out, till eventually I was just on the run. It felt like I was on the run all the time. You know, everything's kind of a blur between 2012 and 2015. For me to try to put that into timeline, I don't know how I would do it. But, I'd go down to Mesa or whatever, where I knew I had hookups. And I was a smaller fish in a bigger pond again. And I wasn't running around the streets of Flagstaff, showing my face. I was just trying to blend in down there. I got caught one night. There was a bunch of dope in the car. I was with a dude that I really had no business being with. It was on Super Bowl weekend. They pulled us over and I ran. I left the car and I hid in a recycle bin dumpster. And I heard the helicopter. I heard the cops driving around until I heard the helicopter right above me. And that's when I realized that the heat thermal imaging had spotted me in this fucking dumpster. And next thing you know, I see the light shining in and Mesa PD come out with her hands up. I'm like, yeah, fuck that. You gotta drag me out of this motherfucker. Mesa PD come out or we're sending the dog in and cheesed up real quick, put them hands up, and And Mesa PD, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, give cops a bad rap, but, you know, there's a lot of stories of people getting shot that don't have a weapon and stuff down in the valley. And that's because of the, I believe that that's because of the craziness they have to fucking deal with on a daily basis. Mm. And, you know, they kept telling me to get out and had me at gunpoint. I can't get out. And I'm afraid that if I go down here towards my waist, I'm going to get shot.
Yeah.
And they got the dog snapping at me, dude, you know, and, till finally says, holsters his weapon, says, I'm getting him, grabs me, pulls me straight out onto my face, dude. They kick me, you know, they knee me in the back and, what the fuck are you running for, you piece of shit, you know? And, like, those words stuck in my mind, you know? And the friend of mine that was in the front seat had taken the, you know, the couple ounces of what he had, what he was selling. I don't want to say too much on here. I guess I didn't use names, but... and he had conveniently placed it in the back next to where my backpack was. I always made sure I was very weird about how I did things. Everything was easy to get rid of or stash so well that if you find it, you can fucking charge me with it. And that's how I felt, you know? Plus, I didn't have enough to fucking really, you know, I wasn't really concerned about hiding a huge bag, you right. know? I was always kind of, you know, just trying to make it through to the next high. You know, and they were very persistent about that being mine, and I was like, dude, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how many times I need to tell you that's not mine. The only thing in that ride is the backpack, and if you find something in that backpack, you can charge me with it. But other than that, I have nothing else to say. I want my attorney. You know, nothing ever came of it. They had me on felony warrants out of Flagstaff and Yavapai County. I got my felonies up in Flagstaff. I had to, like, it was a class 6 is what they pleaded me out to, because it was my my first time being in big boy trouble. And the presumptive on class 6, the average time is a year. I had already done in probation violations, my time sitting in Maricopa waiting to go to Yavapai and going back and forth. I had done over a year. So they just terminated my probation, and I got spit down to Yavapai. To where they put me on intensive probation for an ag DUI that I had gotten. Aggravated DUI. Which is, out of all the stuff that I have on my record, and aggravated DUI is a class 4 felony, and for people who don't know, it goes, you know, murder and stuff like that is, you know, F1 all the way up to class 6. This was a class 4, which carries a presumptive of 2.5 years, mandatory prison time. Which I had already, you know, served on somewhere in there a few months. You know, I met a girl in rehab, you know, that's where I find all the good romances, right? So once I started screwing up, you know, I take a hostage. She had a car and, you know, she still had some things in life, that her family was helping her with. And that was the last time to where I was on the run. I got caught up and, you know, the judge looked at me and said, you know, your chances, you're burnt, dude. Like, you're not fooling me. You're doing your prison time and we're going to be done with this. You know, I don't know who you think you're fooling, but you ain't fooling me. And, you know, I really thought I was going to get reinstated, until I finally had to, do my time. With the back time I had, I only ended up doing, I think, around 18 months. I got locked up in November 2015 and got out March 17. I don't know if that math's right, but...
And she get out close... No, that makes sense.
And that's when I met Richie's beautiful face.
Yeah, what was prison like?
Prison? Prison...
Were you sober the whole time in prison?
Absolutely not.
You want to tell me about that? What's that like?
There are lots of drugs in there. Okay. It's flooded with drugs.
How did they get the drugs in?
Well, there's multiple ways.
Well, tell me about them. This is what I want to talk about.
There's a Sonic across the street. There's a Sonic across the street. And, I mean, other than the walls, I was on a low-level DUI yard. And other than the, you know, the fences, you could throw a rock and hit Sonic, so if you could throw a rock and hit Sonic,
you could throw a
fucking tennis ball full of dope and hit the yard.
Yeah.
So slingshots, drones were coming into the picture around the time I was leaving.
Yeah.
And then visitation. It was always the way because we could visit like we're visiting here. And
they didn't search people when they did.
Oh, they did. It was in a special place, if you know what I mean.
Oh. Good old keister.
This is what you've been looking for the whole time, Richard. Yeah, That's why I'm here. You want to hear about hiding shit in your butt, don't you?
Yeah. I want to hear about prison and drugs and how prison's a joke. That's what I want to hear about.
Well, we all know prison's a joke.
Prison.
So, how did you... So you have to like make a living in prison, right?
What was it like getting high in prison?
If you're indigent, which means you have no money, you have no support, most of the time on the lower level yards, you're allowed to work. What you work for is around 10 to 15 cents an hour unless you can get a clearance, a C clearance to go outside and work on like APS, Salt River Project, like different places like that.
Right.
The recycling center. Because of the amount of times that I ran, I was never allowed. Even if I were to go back now, they would never let me go outside the gate. So I worked in the kitchen. The worst job on the yard that everyone said to have was AM kitchen, which starts at about 2 a.m. is when you gotta wake up and you gotta report by 2:30. Lucky me. Guess what I got? Guess what job I got?
AM
kitchen fucking crew, dude. And I was miserable. I'd never toughed anything out in my life, dude. I didn't want to fucking do it, but I had nowhere to run. I would lose visits. I would lose privileges if I didn't report to work. So I had to do it. And it turned out not being that bad. I think that's the scariest part about prison is you can get comfortable in there. I don't know if this is still... the same way, but tobacco was, you could buy on commissary, chew, cigarettes, you know, you have some luxuries, you got your TV lineup. If you don't have enough money to buy a TV, you can rent a TV. If you don't have any money to rent a TV, you can hustle, you know, and, there's ways to do everything and arts and crafts, you can, you know, like, there's a lot of paisas in there that's all they do is arts and crafts, and they make a killing. Like,
what's a paisa?
A paisa is an illegal that wasn't born in the United States and is serving. They do about 50% of their time before they're sent back. I don't know the reasoning behind that, but that the races are very segregated. Even on the lower level yards, Arizona prisons, you got your Woods, your Whites, you got your Chicanos, you got your Kinfolk, which are your Blacks, and you got your Chicano. I already said Chicanos, Paisas, and then your Dene and Warrior Society, which are pretty much Apaches and Navajos that they separate themselves. The minority would be. In the state of Arizona, is natives and the kinfolk, you know, and so shit pops off. Typically the Chicanos get with the whites and nobody really, stands a chance, you know, but if there's beef between the Chicanos and the whites, you know, it's a problem. It's a shit show. Yeah. You know, I was lucky enough to never be a part of a riot. The last yard I was on was a lower level yard, so they don't have, you know, you got it pretty good when you're making money.
Right.
You have your freedoms on the low level yard. You're able to walk around and go from place to place, see your family and, at food visits and visitation and stuff. But, so you're trying to keep what you got, and nobody on a low level yard is doing a life sentence. It's five and under. But I've been on yards. I've been on a higher yard that was medium security, that was a level 3, because I had a felony warrant. When I had to do my little piddly 4 months for my ag DUI, they sent me to a medium class yard, which there's lifers on that yard. There's dudes that have murdered. But that's as low as they get, is a class 3 or a level 3 yard. It's medium security. You got one more barbed wire to get through. But there's dudes on there that will stab you for a fucking soup. you know, yeah. if you owe them a soup. And that was one thing that always scared me. I didn't want to get any fights. I didn't want to get in anyone's fucking way, dude. I just wanted to get through my time and I wanted to fucking go home in one piece.
Right.
And so I watched. I watched my bunkie when I was on that level 3 yard PC up because he didn't want to get smashed down for the spice debt that he had racked up.
Oh, shit.
And so I saw that if you don't have the money, you don't get in debt.
Yeah.
If you do anything on the yard and drug related or any of that, you come with your money correct or you have your family wire it, but you don't touch nothing until you got that in hand.
Right.
'Cause it just causes problems. And so I dealt with hooch working in the kitchen. I was able to pass out hooch kits and sell those and trade those for a little bit of, you know, my drug of choice. And, which is yeast, potatoes, sugar,
sugar,
boxes of sugar. And we passed those out through the chute, you know? And so I was able to sell those cause I was an AM kitchen cook is what I ended up becoming. And, you know, the guard would bring in, like on the weekends when we'd be the only ones that would have to work, you know, because people got to eat, you know, she would bring in like bacon and like, carne asada. And so we'd make omelets in the morning, you right. know, and it made it not so fucking bad. And like I said, I think that was the scariest part is how comfortable you can get with routine. Just, you know, I was watching people leave and come back at like a revolving door. And I'm like, I don't want to fucking be that.
I'm glad you were talking about slinging hooch because one of my friends who wasn't indigent, he got set up through his family when he went to prison. He still did stuff to make money and he sold porn basically. He would get like pictures like made and like you'd make copies or laminate them and people would take them in the shower.
Take them in the shower
and stick them up business, on the wall. Dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's just... cause I mean, like he had a TV and a CD player and all that shit that you can get, but he still needed something to do, you know what
right.
I mean? And so that's what he did just to do something, anything, you know? And it was definitely my experience too. I never went to prison, but I did like 4 months, I think total, like in like one stretch in county here. And I was a trustee and, working floors and I worked 12-hour shifts, you know what I mean? Like 7 days a week. And I was so busy. I was just so tired to not be, content, you know what I mean? Like working from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and then fucking just fucking go to bed. You know? That was it. What's the craziest thing you ever seen in prison?
Cell phones. That shit's fucking crazy, dude. When I walked into the bathroom and saw a dude on a fucking, on a smartphone, surfing Facebook, that tripped me the fuck out, dude. You know? It's like, that's such a reality shock of, like, where you are and what's not allowed and, like, everything and, like, how much... That is a class 4 felony as well, and they'll take you off... If they catch you with a phone, they'll charge you with a class 4 felony and they'll stack it on top.
Most of the time,
they won't run it concurrent. They'll run it consecutive, which means after you're done with the time that you're serving, you do another 2.5. And they don't really mess around with the cell phones too much. I used them all the time.
Like, what if they found you with drugs?
I mean, that's class 4 too.
Street charge you. Yeah, they would street charge you as is. They'd take you to the county across the street, the county jail, and you would get processed in like you had just got caught up on the street. And you would get sentenced, and then you'd start your whole fucking trip over again. So yeah, I mean, but the hiding spots and the fucking tattoos and just, it's such a crazy experience. Like, and the lower level yard, the more freedom you have, which means the more slack they give you and the more shit you can fucking get into.
Yeah.
And it was crazy, man. And
you never got any ink in prison, did you?
I didn't. No, I didn't have a tattoo on my body until
yeah, we got the matching feet tattoo.
Yeah, we fucking do. yeah, we do, man. But you know, I was told I was lucky enough. Like one of the cooks that I met in prison, I was pretty much. He was one of the higher level woods in there and was plugged in with everyone in there. And who you know in there and who you hang out with is kind of who you are. Me fitting into the cook area. They kind of took me under their wing. I told them I didn't really want to, you know,
get political.
I mean, you kind of have to. You got to
right,
stick
a little
your
bit,
own
right?
Kind.
Yeah.
But I told them I didn't want to. You know, they offered. They said, "Hey, you want to make some money selling some spice?" I'm like, "No, I don't want to deal with any of that. You know, I'm just here for like 18 months, and I want to go home. You know, I don't want to catch any more charges." But they were they're kind of OGs in the sense that they have older numbers than I did. You know, they give you a DOC number and. You know, their numbers were still triple digits, some of them below that. But you can tell by the badge that you wear how long ago you've been to prison and usually what your prison career looked like by the number on your ID. You know, and they kind of took me under the wing, and that's who I worked out with. That's who I played cards with. That's who I gambled with. That's who I went to if I needed fucking anything. And it, you know, to have that crew or whatever you want to call it, dude, like your group of people, like that helps you get through. And they told me, like, focus and put your time and energy into fucking getting ready to get out. So I didn't have my, GED or, you know, I didn't graduate high school. I got my GED in prison. I went to class and did all that, you know, and I took advantage of those opportunities in there and, you know, kind of set myself up for taking step forward instead of making, I made the best of my time. So, and that's what they taught me. I know you were looking for butt stuff, Richie. I'm sorry, dude. I ain't got no butt stuff.
How were drugs in prison, dude?
How were drugs? Yeah. You need a microscope to see them, unless you were filthy rich and your family would wire money.
How'd you
too.
Do them?
Snorted. That's how I did them. You would dilute it into a water cap, a bottle cap, that you get from your RC off a commissary, and you'd stir it up, dude, and you'd tip a cap back is what they call it, you know, and you just put it in there and you put some water to make sure you get everything that you just fucking paid for, because I didn't even see it, you know, when you handed me a 40 sack. Like, they smash it out and they call them papers is what they call them, and some dude will heat up his water and fucking and put it between plastic and he would smear it out to make it look bigger than it was, but you can see through the shit,
right?
You know, and this is heroin, and then they'd cut it up from there, and they'd sell them in like $20 papers and this and that. And I didn't really buy too much. I did go to meetings and stuff in there. My bunkie had a big addiction, and he had some money on the outs, and he was always able to, you know, come across it whenever it would come onto the yard. So when you got a bunkie or a cellmate or whatever, I mean, we were housed with like 60 people in our pod is what they called it. There was like 60 dudes in that. But your bunkmate is usually, you know, you guys live together. You know everything about each other. Hey, bunk, let me borrow this. Or, hey, you got, you know, and you wake up, you see your ugly bunkie's fucking face. You go to sleep. Last person you saw is your fucking bunkie, you know, and. So he would always throw me a little bit. There were rigs on the yard every now and then. Someone would steal them from medical. Somebody from the recycling place would come across one. And those go for big money in there, you know?
Yeah.
And
you get like 100 uses out of that thing too, probably.
And motherfuckers filing them down with, you know, on the concrete. Yeah. Like, and it... You know, everyone's very political until it comes time to get loaded on the yard, and you gotta borrow you're a head white dude, but you gotta borrow the syringe from the kinfolk that's got it right now. You know, everything's real political, can't share food or do any of that, but we can pass the syringe around and trade blood and all that stuff, you know, and that was, that's not something I got into in there. I never did enough. I was focused on, working out and getting my GED, and that was enough to get me through and wait until my next visit to see my family. Phone calls and, you know, all that stuff. By the time I had my television lineup, I was ready to go to bed when the lights turned off at 10 and it got quiet. So,
did you ever feel like you were spinning your wheels? I know, like, every time I like visited with my family while I was locked up, it was always like, I have nothing new to share. You know what I mean? It's the same fucking shit. Like, tell me about your life, but then when they don't have anything new to share, like, you know what I mean? It's just, like, dead silence, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's nothing else going on, and it's so weird.
I was lucky that, you know, my mom and my aunt were the only ones that really ever came to see me. My ride-or-die chick made it about, she didn't even make it until I hit prison. So, you know.
Did you expect her to?
2 months. I don't know what the fuck I thought, dude, you know?
I thought that a couple times.
Yeah,
you know,
dude,
what I'm saying?
You really do kind of think that, that she's going to have a house and a place to go when you get out, and she's going to put money on your books. Well, that never fucking happened. The only ones that were there for me, I was able to talk to my dad a couple times on the chopper, as they called it, which is just the prison phone. But, you know, my aunt and my, in order to communicate or to have visitations, they have to take time and fill out paperwork and put money into things. And my mom and my aunt were the only ones to do that, to take that time for me and to do that. And so when I'd go to visitations, they'd always get a kick. They're very, you know, no drug addicts or no alcoholics really in the family. I was like the only one, and they always get a kick of like the stories, you know, kind of right. What I'm doing here, you know, the prison, you know, and what it's like and what's going on. And my mom would like get to know through visitation, like you have some of your buddies in there at the same time visiting with their family. And you're not supposed to talk with other families, but sometimes they would, you know, say what's up, and my mom would talk to them. So, you know, it was cool to be able to, you know, share with my family about, you know, what's going on with me and stuff in there.
Yeah, I don't think my family knew much about that side either until I started, and now they're, you know, relative experts, I guess, you know. And
yeah.
It's funny. But, thanks. I learned stuff today, you know.
I still don't got no butt stuff for you, Richie. I'm sorry.
We can,
dude.
It's all right, we can learn about butt stuff right now. Together.
Together.
Do we keep recording? Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, man. Sorry I wasted, you know, some time not getting to the good shit, dude.
Wasted.
Wasted. It was great. It's fantastic.
Just leaves for an episode 2. That's all.
Episode yeah. 2.
Or
the prison pocket.
Part 2.
Pocket. Yeah, part 2.
No, it's all good. Don't worry about it. You didn't waste no time. How is it wasting time?
I don't know.
It's not wasting nothing. I love you. Thank you for doing this.
Love you guys too.
Love you, Dusty.
You got anything special? No?
No.
Okay.
Thank you guys for listening. If you like the podcast, please hit like and share. Tell your friends, family, maybe not kids just yet, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
Rated R.
Yeah.
You guys have a beautiful day.